In 1598, a comment was published that a play had won applause at the Curtain Theatre in Shoreditch. Young Romeo is doomed to be banished from Verona and should leave the day after his wedding night or die.
Wilt thou be gone? It is not yet near day. It was the nightingale and not the lark that pierced the fearful hollow of thine ear. Nightly she sings on yon pomegranate tree. Believe me, love, it was the nightingale.
It was the lark, the herald of the morn, no nightingale. Look, look, love, what envious streaks do lace, severing clouds in yonder east. Night's candles are burned out, and yonkin day stands tiptoe on the misty mountaintops. I must be gone and live, or stay and die.
Yon light is not daylight. I know it, aye. It is some meteor that the sun exhaled to be to thee this night a torchbearer, a light thee on thy way to Mantua. Therefore stay yet, thou is not to be gone.
Okay. Let me be tamed. Let me be put to death. I am content, so thou wilt have it so. I say, dawn grace, not the morning's eye, 'tis but the pale reflex of Cynthia's brow. Nor that is not the lark whose notes do beat the vaulty heaven so high above our clouds. I have more care to stay than will to go. Come, death, and welcome. Juliet wills it so. How is it, my soul? Let's talk. It is not day.
It is, it is. I hence be gone away. It is the lark that sings out of tune, straining harsh discords and unpleasing sharps. Some say the lark makes sweet division. This doth not so, for she divideth us. Some say the lark and Luther toad change eyes. Oh, now I would they changed voices too. Oh, now be gone, more light and light it grows.
More light and light, more dark and dark our woes.
Light and dark, night and day. For a long time now, the Curtain Playhouse in Shoreditch, scene of a first airing of
Once More Into the Breach, Dear Friends, Once More.
And the love tragedy, Romeo and Juliet, has needed a proper break, or should that be a breach, of daylight. The star-crossed lovers play, and Henry V, that nationalistic, war-centred history drama, were performed by Shakespeare's acting company, the Chamberlain's Men, at the Curtain Playhouse in the late 1590s, after having to leave their own purpose-built theatre while it endured lease troubles. Downers are, quotes, easer for these Shoreditch actors. The Curtain saw a visit by them between 1597 and 1598, subject as it was to a neighbourly agreement between local playhouse owners. But this theatre, first organised when William Shakespeare was a Stratford teenager, had been going for some time by then, and from a year unknown. For us, it has needed illumination because we've only ever understood it as an also-ran. We haven't known what to do with it, only managing barely to understand that it was there. All of the above may change after excavations in Shoreditch this year, and in the light of what has been found there, and what may yet be realised about it with research to come. Here is that word, easel. Right, so it's right in the middle there. That's an E, a big E. S-O-R-E. Easel. Residing in the Public Record Office in Kew, will it become any easier to understand this playhouse after the excavations? The text of the prologue to Henry V refers to a wooden O, and what was found this year makes us hesitate over implications. Maybe the job for theatre history is not so easy. Where should we begin? Are we in Verona today? Are we in Agincourt? No, we're in a muddy field in Shoreditch. The first thing we've got to understand about this playhouse is that it was not erected in built-up London. It was constructed or adapted, as many theatres were, in the Middlesex suburbs, in a field called the Curtain. This field was called the Curtain, not just the playhouse. This theatre was just down the road from that other playhouse that came to the Easor agreement with it, which was built in the grounds of an old priory. This was James Burbage's theatre, called the theatre because it was the only one existing at the time, or so tradition has it, purpose-built. The two venues were in competition with one another, no doubt, before becoming neighbourly aides just prior to the move of the Chamberlain's men to the Bankside and their famous globe. What was it, this other place, this curtain, this also-ran of a theatre, this demi-playhouse downplayed so much of the time into footnotes and into parentheses, this place where Shakespeare's company moved when they got into trouble with their landlord? This is the Rither map, which is in the room, I think, and there's this rather round-looking theatre there, just off the street in Shoreditch. James Burbage's theatre, according to our imaginations, was always polygonal. Our minds at work on these early playhouses over a long period of theatre history time. This assumption about the theatre was given weight by lots of things, including the fact that the same timbers we used to build it were again used at the polygonal globe. And this assumption of its round nature was confirmed again by recent archaeological excavations.
What does polygonal mean?
Many-sided, like Shakespeare's globe.
As opposed to?
Quadrilateral, four-sided. This is the Corral de Comedias de Almagro, a quadrilateral-shaped theatre in Spain.
The Corral de Comedias de Almagro.
yes, that's what it was. Which David Amelang here will be talking about later because he knows about it. When Heather Knight mentioned Spanish theatres to me, I asked David to come. He will be talking about it because, and here's the news, what Heather Knight, lead archaeologist, she's sitting over there, on the Curtain site, found this year on the spot where a round curtain playhouse should be, was quadrilateral. That is, four-sided remains for some reason. And here lies a deep-rooted psychological problem. What we thought should be basically
round
turns out to be, according to the bricks found,
square.
The reason I am here is because I know something about quadrilateral playhouses. The Red Bull Playhouse, the one I know the most about, was built in 1605, later than the Curtain. It was built, however, by a time when players and instigators of playhouses had learned what was best, what suited them. The Red Bull was built not far from here, about a third of a mile from where we are now. It was converted into a playhouse from the yard of an inn, with the first people performing there working under the patronage of Anna of Denmark, James the First Queen. There she is. But the Red Bull was not the only playhouse licensed to this company. They were also allowed to play at the Curtain in Shoreditch. Moreover, in around 1604, when a patent for the new company was drafted, there it is, the text stipulated that a playhouse called the Boar's Head, as well as the Curtain, would act as two of this company's venues. The Boar's Head and the Curtain were down as the Queen's servants' quotes, now usual housen. The Boar's Head, for your info, was a rectangular yard-based theatre too. It's a close-up of the housen sentence. The housen sentence means that Queen Anna's men had performed before at the Curtain and perhaps had played there for some time. In the Tudor period, the company who became the Queen's servants were Edward Somerset, the 4th Earl of Worcester's troupe. That's him. This was a company that only in desperate circumstances performed at Philip Henslowe's Round Rose on the Bankside. It is therefore very interesting to me that what Heather Knight found in Shoreditch was more
square
than
round.
Because if Heather is right, when this company performed, they preferred to do so in quadrilateral rather than polygonal theatres. The title of this morning's talk is The Measure of the Curtain, Instigators, Owners, Sharers and Players. To be honest, I have no plans to talk about instigators today because I know of no real evidence about when this playhouse started, only something about how it continued. Instead of concentrating on the people who started this playhouse, therefore, I'd like to present a brief helicopter shot of the field in which the curtain was built, determined to understand something of the character and detail of relevant people in terms of Shoreditch and the theatre world there. This is in hopes of suggesting research pathways for future investigation. Some of these theatre people associated with the Shoreditch field were actors, although they were not exclusively actors. They could be, for example, playwrights. I will be concentrating on one actor in particular, Christopher Beeston, who went on to have a considerable influence on the development of theatre, and one playwright, not Shakespeare, but surprisingly for me, Thomas Middleton, author of The Changeling, for example, and the notorious Game at Chess. I have a list. It's a list of many people associated with that field through ownership. One of the awkward things about researching the Curtin Playhouse is the fact that its name, the Curtin, is the same as its location. Just to be clear, as many people have had to be clear before me, this name does not refer to curtains, the swishy things around windows, as we might understand them. It alludes to an old meaning associated with walls. And for a moment, with these walls in mind, we can remain medieval. Before actors got there, before playhouses were built, this field in Shoreditch was in the tenure of a community of nuns. Here in this book, in a useful essay by J.L. Kirby, we learn that the Priory of St. John the Baptist at Halliwell, or Holywell, no doubt at one time set around a holy well, was a house of Augustinian canonesses. This was where the Burbage's Theatre was built. The field to the south of it belonged to the Priory too, and was possessed of a distinctive wall marking it off. This was where the curtain was built. The wall is mentioned in a number of documents. Here is the way the curtain property was described when it was transferred to Thomas Harbert, or Herbert, a girdler of London, in 1581. He received...
all that the house, tenement or lodge commonly called the curtain, and also all that parcel of ground enclosed-walled and enclosed with a brick wall on the west and north parts, and in part with a mud wall at the west side or end towards the south, called also the curtain close, together with all the gardens, fish ponds, wells, and brick walls to the premises.
So you see a difficulty immediately. There was a house or lodge called...
the curtain.
And there was a parcel of ground, a close, called...
the curtain.
And there were all sorts of buildings and so forth built on this close called...
the curtain.
Confusion could reign. With this priory field status, in fact, the curtain finds its first early points of contact with the Red Bull Playhouse, which was also built on ex-monastic land, also once belonging to Augustinian canonesses, this time those at the Priory of St. Mary Clerkenwell, very close to here. This was also a community set around a well, the Clerk's Well, or Clerkenwell, where this area, where we are here at the LMA, gets its name. This was a medieval area too, associated with entertainment. The field where the Red Bull was built came to be known as St. Mary's Close, just as the curtain was built in an area sometimes called Curtain Close. After the Reformation in England, when Henry VIII took what had been church-owned land and made it more malleably state-owned, a lot of changes happened on these fields, much of it to do with building. Here are photographs of my list. It is of all the owners taken from records that I have seen mentioned in association with that field in Shoreditch. It begins with the last prioress in place before the Reformation, and it extends to the actors and other people mentioned in later documents. There are 58 names I have so far listed here, and it is not exhaustive. I have not yet had time to look at all the documents possible. The trouble with a list like this is not so much the numbers of people involved, but the sources often appearing to disagree with one another when it comes to the people. When I see this, does it mean I'm looking at property changing hands very quickly, Or is it that we're seeing different kinds of holdings? Today we have freehold and leasehold ownership in England. And that is complicated enough. Then we had freehold, leasehold, copyhold, and other kinds of holding too, I believe. Here I have picked out the names that interest me on this master list of mine. So, well, an Earl of Southampton, probably not that one, but one after, you know, his son or something. He was a friend of Shakespeare's, we know that. This man, Sir Thomas Lee, not much is known about him except he was an ambassador to Denmark. But he interests me because of an actor in my company called Robert Lee. Very naughty actor. I'll tell you about him a bit later. And it would explain a great deal if he was related to somebody rich, because he was very confident, and not much is known about Robert Lee. Thomas Harbutt, the girdler. It's that name Herbert, which you'll see on the next line down. This particular Philip, Lord Herbert, 4th Earl of Pembroke, he had something to do with the folio. He helped with all that, I think. So those are the posher people on my list who could be valuable for research in the future. Now this one, this is the one where the Middletons come into the frame. The record is actually recorded in the Survey of London, but it doesn't mention Thomas Middleton as such, I don't think. Yes, this lease that Sir Thomas Lee owned, long lease, he eventually got the freehold, in fact, of the thing, but the lease, so you see what I mean about the different kinds of holdings, came into the hands of William Middleton, who was a brick tiler. And he happened to be the father of Thomas Middleton, the famous playwright. And so we have a situation where a very young Thomas Middleton, there were lots of arguments about the things that Thomas Middleton inherited from his father when he died very young. We have a situation where his brother-in-law said, I will pay for your college education if you give me this. So this is the list. Oh, that's the actual record at the National Archives of that. And this is the list of the people mentioned as being tenants on that land under the Middletons. And what draws my attention particularly is Mary Wilkinson, widow, because Wilkinson, I think, is the other name for Nicholas Tooley, who was an actor with the Chamberlain's Men. And then particularly the widow Beston. Now, could that be Mrs. Beeston? Mrs. Beeston, who was buried in the Bishopsgate area, and a relative, one assumes, called Robert Beeston, looked after that estate. And we're not sure, but it could be the brother or relative of Christopher Beeston. And they were both in the company that interests me. So those names sing out from that National Archives record. To cut a very long story short, if one wished it, one could see all of early theatre history flourishing in this field in Shoreditch. When it comes to actor ownership, however, I confess I am most interested in one owner-player-sharer, given that I am in the early stages of co-writing a book about him. And looking at his association with the field rather than the playhouse, while gazing at a combination of documents and maps, we can realise a great deal about this person. Christopher Beeston was with Shakespeare's company as a young man. He is in the useful cast list of Ben Jonson's Every Man in His Humour of the latter 1590s, which we know was performed by the Chamberlain's Company at the Curtain. Beeston then moved, around the time of that company's escape to the Bankside Globe, to the Earl of Worcester's troupe. This is the company that interests me, the ones who became Queen Anna of Denmark's men, performing at the Red Bull and the Curtain. And Beeston was to become actor manager of that company, somehow going on to build the first theatre in the Drury Lane area of London. The first theatre in what we now call the West End. The Cockpit Playhouse, this was, built in 1616. To explain how Beeston managed to achieve this kind of success, we could return to Romeo and Juliet, not unfortunately, that romantically. After the lovers meet for the first time and they kiss, Juliet is called away to her mother and Romeo asks the nurse,
"What is her mother?"
"Mary, bachelor. Her mother is the lady of the house, and a good lady, and a wise and virtuous. I nursed her daughter that you talked with all. I tell you, he that can lay hold of her shall have the chinks."
This last line of the nurse means that whoever wins Juliet's hand will become rich. Beeston, a member of Shakespeare's company, performing in Shoreditch in the 1590s, a relative perhaps of that quote's Mrs. Beston, with property near these entertainment venues around the Curtain pasture, married Jane Sands in 1602 and became rich. According to Christopher Matusiak's research, Professor Matusiak is my co-author on the Beeston book, Jane Sands was a daughter of Anthony Sands, innholder of the King's Head in Shoreditch. Her sister Cicely had married another actor in the 1590s, an Englishman called Robert Brown, who toured Europe acting and who was linked to the Earl of Worcester's men, the ones I'm interested in. In the teeth of his forthcoming lucrative marriage, however, 1602 was not without its embarrassments for Christopher Beeston. Earlier that year, as Professor Salkeld could tell you, because this is his research, he's sitting there, he had been accused of consorting with a woman, now pregnant, who accused Beeston of possessing her
forcibly.
Beeston was said to have scoffed, commenting that he had had sex with
100 wenches in my time.
Despite this mishap, Beeston must have convinced the judges of this woman's malicious intent in accusing him of rape, and he married the innholder's daughter without further fuss. He got himself the chinks, in other words, big time. This is in the room with us, this document. It was through his marriage to Jane Sands that Beeston came by many rights to the King's Head Inn, a property that was, in the end, handed down to his son William, and was probably the great source of a great deal of independent income set apart from his earnings as an actor. Here at the LMA lives one of the most beautiful-looking witnesses to his property-owning chink's life. It is a tripartite agreement he signed in 1605 and is on display. It was about a tenancy and a right of way from the King's Head to part of Curtain Close, and a tract of land which Beeston already owned. And there's Beeston's signature. This is under his other name. He's very often Christopher Beeston, alias Hutchinson or Hitchinson, or sometimes he's Hitchinson, alias Beeston. But that's him. His King's Head arrangements are also recorded elsewhere. Here is one record found in the close rolls of the National Archives. Where was the King's Head Inn? Well, funnily enough, it was just across the field from Beeston's workplace, the Curtain, where in the 1590s he was performing with Shakespeare's company. How do we know the location of this King's Head Inn? When I went to see Heather Knight at an initial meeting on the excavation site, she showed me a number of maps, some of which I'd viewed before, but perhaps not with Heather's bricks-finding concentration. There are two I am interested in particular. The first, Peter Chassereau's map, is in fact an 18th century representation of Shoreditch. The other is the Ogilby and Morgan map of 1676. Ogilby and Morgan's doesn't include the place of the excavation site, unfortunately, as Heather pointed out. But this is Peter Chassereau's map. Jassereau's map is good, not only because it concentrates on Shoreditch, but because it has a key, with names of the places matched against numbers. There's the key in particular. If we consult the map and the key, it would appear that the King's Head Yard was situated right there. Okay, there's the field. yes. The bit where the playhouse was built, according to Mola's excavations, was here. That's right, isn't it, Heather? Yep. Here is Ogilby and Morgan's map, where, with the use of another key, we can say that the King's Head was here. So this one's a lot more detailed. So when I said, "Oh, what about Ogilby and Morgan's map?" She said, "It's not there. It's off the scale." I sort of laughed because actually, that is interesting. You see, that's so detailed. Yeah. And he got rights to go in. Here is Ogilby and Morgan's map, where with use of here, it was all just a romantic cheek-seeking trudge across the field from the curtain. The invocation of Romeo and Juliet is appropriate to Christopher Beeston. To begin with, while with Shakespeare's company, he was the right age to have played the part of Romeo or Mercutio or even technically Juliet. Unlike Romeo and Juliet, however, nobody died in the last act of a fast-moving play. Christopher and Jane were to go on to have a fair few children and to live a quietly affluent lifestyle. There was, however, something mysteriously tragic about the couple in that Jane possessed proclivities that constantly got Christopher into trouble. No, she didn't drink, as far as we know. She was a Catholic. This was very odd. There were successful Church of England bishops and MPs in the Sands family, very respectable. Yet here in this room is another witness to Christopher Beeston's extraordinary life, one of the many to do with Jane Beeston's recusancy. For a long time, people have been confused by records like these, thinking that it was Christopher who was what we call a recusant, someone who refused to attend Church of England communion because of their religious leanings elsewhere, usually towards Catholicism. As we can see on this record, even the recorder of this list thought that it was Christopher who was the guilty party and had to insert Jane's details. So you see, look, they put that's how you do Christopher. You do a sort of Christ representation and then an Ophir, Beeston, he's the one. And then they had to put a little arrow, Jana, Beeston, Uxall. Yes, wife. The records of Jane's recusancy were made at a time when the Beestons had moved to Clerkenwell to be near their new theatre, the Red Bull. Another oddity about the family's commitment to the Curtain Close area is that when they left, a small son remained behind in Shoreditch, Robert Beeston. Presumably young Robert was left with relatives associated with the King's Head. Robert Beeston died in Shoreditch in 1615 at the age of 6, while the rest of his family were living in Clerkenwell. Thinking about Christopher Beeston and his relationship with the Curtain site, the document that's crucial is this one. These kinds of record are called close rolls, and if you leave it too late to look at them at the PRO, it's hell on wheels rolling them out, and it's a very close thing rolling them back up again. See, he's nodding. I'm glad Julian Bowsher is here today, because it was he who sent me an email recently referring to this record, and he quoted from it. Edward Morris, embroiderer, was to receive with this transaction
all that parcel of pasture ground nigh the curtain, and adjoining to the premises on two sides containing 3 roods and 10 perches, now or late in the tenure or occupation of Christopher Beeston, alias Hitchinson, and also all that large messuage or tenement built of timber and thatched, now in decay, called the curtain with a parcel of grounds adjoining thereto, wherein they used to keep stage plays, now or late in the tenure and occupation of Thomas Green, his assignee or assigns.
A rood is a quarter of an acre, as I understand it, and it is made up of 40 perches, apparently. A rood must never be mixed up with a rod, which is different. Concerning this close roll, Julian goes on to comment in his email that the meaning and syntax are slippery, that maybe the land adjoining the curtain tenement, Christopher Beeston's bit, was where the playhouse was, and that this land might be where the plays were staged. Well, we know Christopher Beeston owned a bit of land adjoining the King's Head Inn from those Sands records. Owning this land would have made it possible both to have access from the King's Head for horses' purposes, which it was claimed it was needed for, and perhaps to have access to the field where one could reach the playhouse. According to the Morris record, the measure of land given was separated off from an earlier measurement in the text of 3 roods and 5 perches, probably covering many buildings on the land itemised by person. The sum of land recorded during this portion of the text, Christopher Beeston's and Thomas Green's, and including that of a man called Baldwin, measured 3 roods and 10 perches. And from the syntax, I'd say this land of Beeston's may well have joined that of Thomas Green, who was the clown and manager of the Queen's Servants Company at this time, working with Beeston and the Queen's Servants, playing both at the curtain and the Red Bull. It is this Thomas Green, the clown who is pointed towards in the text, as more owning the curtain playhouse here. So in answers to Julian's question querying what these two men were up to here, I'd say it was all about access to the playhouse from all corners of the field. Thinking about this, and I'm no measurements expert, we have Peter McCurdy who might know, but I'm not. Wouldn't it be handy, wherever this playhouse was, to have access through an inn yard if you were going touring, for instance? And so the horses could be stabled here. Be very handy, wouldn't it? You get these ideas once you're looking at a whole field instead of just where's the garage, where to park the van. There is some difficulty evident with all these measurements and maps, I should say. Here, the whole document should be describing 6 roods and 15 perches in all, which is equivalent to about 1.5 acres, in my understanding. But on Chassereau's map, there are 3 acres shown, no roods and 25 perches. For more extraordinary comparison, I've seen a court case involving Beeston's land there, where one party estimated the whole curtain land at 10 acres, far greater than anyone else would ever have guessed or anything like the size it could have been. I think all these documents are slippery, in other words, all of them. Thomas Green, incidentally, was not the only clown associated with the curtain. Will Kemp, who also left Shakespeare's company at roughly the same time as Beeston, may have performed there as one of Worcester's men. There is a play called The Travails of the Three English Brothers, which was part of the Queen's Servants' repertoire and which has a publisher's record linking it to the curtain. In this play, Kemp, as a character, comes on stage to meet the Shirley brothers abroad. We also know this play was performed at the Red Bull. William Rowley, one of the writers of The Travails and likely to be identified as, quotes, the fat fool of the curtain in the song advertised on the flyers for this event, performed there with a later company and continued to write plays associated with the house. Thomas Pope, the clown, owned shares in the curtain, as well as the Globe, which he left in his will. So here we come to think about those initial questions concerning what kind of second fiddle playhouse it was. Was it good in some way for broad comedy? This is one answer, but there are others perhaps related to it. It was a venue advertised for fencing displays, for example, so this was another skill you could see exercised there. The only play where we have title page evidence of the use of the curtain is one of 1615, which wasn't performed by a known company at all, but by a group of, quotes, young men of the city. This play was called The Hector of Germany and was also performed at the Red Bull. Indeed, many of the plays we know were put on at the Curtain had a young feel about them, Romeo and Juliet being one. And it could be perceived, now this is just me working on instinct, as a good experimental place, a tryout venue, which from time to time could be used in the training of young actors. And I think of Killigrew saying to Pepys much later on, oh, what we need is a nursery. That's what we need right now. It's one idea. The Queen's servants certainly became very interested in involving themselves with troops of youths towards the end of their efforts together in the late teens and early 1620s. There are other things to see here in the room with us relating to the Curtain. The LMA's collection of maps here, for example, some at the back. I think the Chassereau's here, I think. Chassereau's just over there. Fantastic, thank you. Right where Tamsin is. And other documents evoking life of the playhouse. A lot of it not that savoury. We have Ben Jonson's indictment for manslaughter where he killed Gabriel Spencer. And one might pause to wonder at the location of the crime identified, and this is in this record, there's other places people have said, in the quotes, fields at Shoreditch, according to the translation from the Latin. Did the deed take place in the Curtain's field, one wonders. Also, the violent incident involving actors Martin Slatier and Robert Dawes against one Edmund Chambers, a waterman, which was described as an affray and a tumult at the Curtain door. What does, quotes, the Curtain door mean for future Curtain research? Lastly, the upset over Robert Lee, that actor I referred to before, his involvement in a multiple rape case in Norton Folgate, a Liberty in Shoreditch. Yes, we have that in the room with us as well. Although I can't confirm or deny emphatically that the playhouse was either where Heather Knight found it or was of the shape she found it in, if you ask me at the panel session, I can describe to you in what ways it wouldn't surprise me if it were quadrilateral, with a pathway to one side coming off a road. I'd be very interested to hear her latest thinking about what she and her Mola team found, while at the same time I should inform you what I understand, and I'm assuming this is still true, that she is not finished yet. No. It is my understanding that Mola will be investigating other areas around the site of her dig and uncovering more excitements, I am sure, in that field.